This audio is brought to you by Muslim Central. Please consider donating to help cover our running costs and future projects by visiting www.muslimcentral.com/donate.
Hi there, my name is Real Milan and you are listening to Shapers, Makers, Builders and Breakers. We are well into season 2 of Shapers, Makers, Builders and Breakers, a podcast show that started as a passion project during my sabbatical in 2019. The guest that I've interviewed so far underlines the depth of leadership and vision that Africa has, and I am thrilled to showcase Africa's finest minds on this podcast. My recipe remains the same, telling the thought leadership stories that needs to be told by someone that is not a journalist. I approach this podcast as a simple peer-to-peer conversation with amazing people asking the questions that I would like to know. The reaction that I continue to get from the public through these conversations remains inspiring, and I thank Exo Capital for allowing me to continue with this project as part of my day job. Should you have any interesting people that you believe should be featured on the show, please email me at realmalan@me.com. That's realmalan@me.com. Please enjoy the conversations with me as I continue the journey with Shapers, Makers, Builders, and Breakers. Season 2 is brought to you by Exo Capital. Exo Capital is a leading private equity fund manager that through its 12-year history have focused on investing in African businesses with purpose and impact. Exo covers the whole African continent with investment teams based in Cape Town, South Africa and Nairobi, Kenya, currently managing investments in 9 African countries. The core investment thesis revolves around partnering with exceptional businesses and their teams that have the ability to impact Africa in the decades to come. Exo does this through providing growth capital to these businesses, but more than that, leveraging a partnership ethos with the companies they invest in. For more information, please have a look at their website, www.exocapital.com. That is www.exocapital.com. My guest today is someone that most Africans have heard or read about. After many a diary conflict, we finally get to sit down this morning here in Cape Town on a crisp morning here in the center of Cape Town. He's become well known for his humanitarian work in Africa and increasingly internationally. He's a physician. He is a humanitarian. And indeed, in so many ways, he's a carrier of hope and he embodies that which gives us hope as a human race. He's founded the humanitarian organization Gift of the Givers. And Gift of the Givers is a South African-based non-governmental disaster relief group that was established in 1992 to offer disaster relief and responses together with other humanitarian work with the aim to reach people worldwide. And after almost 30 years, it's developed a reputation for speedy responses to floods and wars and famines, fires, tsunamis, kidnappings, earthquakes. The list of disasters just goes on and on. And they're well known for the interventions in South Africa and international disasters and teams and volunteers that are positioned to handle any potential disaster that happens. Interesting that I've read is they possess Africa's only life locator. It's a device that's used to detect people, live people under rubble. He's declined a nomination for the Nobel Peace Prize, which says a lot about the man. He's received 9 honorary doctorates. In addition to the one that he received from the school that he went to, and his achievements and milestones just goes on and on and on. The Gift of the Givers organization's motto is best among people are those who benefit mankind. And it's my great privilege this morning to have a conversation with Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman. Imtiaz, thank you very much for doing this. I know your schedule is much worse than mine, and that says a lot. So maybe I always start these conversations with just a general sort of rundown of your life that shaped you, where you started and how you came to be Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman at this crossroads that you are. And when you get to your enlightenment moment. We're going to pause a little bit there, but maybe just give us a little background of, you know, where did you grow up? What was your early days in your early?
Morning, Riel. I was born in Potchefstroom. Grew up in a community type of environment where grandfather, father, brothers and sisters all lived in one type of complex, communal living. Yeah. Everybody grew up together, shops in the front, house in the back. Everybody eats together, everybody does things together as a family. But it stretches beyond that. As a small community in Potchefstroom, everybody takes care of everyone. There's a wedding, you're not invited, but you come and help. For the funeral, everybody comes. Nobody feels offended for not being invited because you can't invite everybody. Sports, everybody takes part together. Those who are not associated with the sports union and even those associated with the sports union. So when guests come from outside, they don't go to a restaurant. They go to the different homes. So that love, that community building is something you learn. Then, of course, there was the Dr. Ismail Effigy, who eventually became Professor Effigy. He passed on about 2 years ago. And he was the GP. He actually delivered me. He was my doctor when I was a child. And when I saw him and the way he conducted himself so professionally and so spiritually, every year in the month of Ramadan, we have to do additional prayers in the mosque. And somebody has to recite all the 30 chapters of the Holy Quran. Being a doctor, he had also committed the Quran to memory. So in every Ramadan, he used to lead the community as a doctor. And I said, this is the example I like to follow. So at a very young age, I knew I wanted to be a doctor. Not the spiritual part, just the medical part. And of course, eventually I did become a doctor. In 1974, I moved to Durban. But before that stage, my father and them, you know, and the family had a shop, a general dealer. Yes. You sell groceries and you sell clothes. And again, I learned a lot of values from there. The customers would come, buy things on account, can't pay. You know, something happens and they would come back for more groceries. And my father would say, give it to them. They won't pay us back. But their family has supported us for years. It's fine. And the same people would come back and said, now somebody passed on. We need money for funeral. But we haven't paid you for the groceries, and we didn't pay you for the groceries again. And you know, we don't know when we're going to pay you for the funeral. So my father would say, give them the money. We're not going to get it back. And you learn those kind of values, you know, that you learn that when you get from people who are supporting you, you give back and you don't expect to get anything in return. My mother and father divorced. She went back to Durban where she came from. And she said, people need dignity. So she said she's going to set up an employment bureau and find people jobs. And she was very successful, and she says the greatest thing is for people to be independent. And then she used to say, look, we don't have much money, but we should make food parcels and go and find people who need it. So whether we do one, we do four, we do five, but we must be consistent. So we did that with my mother. And then, of course, I moved to Durban, and in 74, I did high school there, matric in Durban, and I got into medical school, what I wanted to do.
Was that Johannesburg or
Durban?
Durban.
It was called University of Natal Medical School. Okay. Now it's the Nelson Mandela School of Medicine.
Yes. Okay.
So I got in there, and in the medical school itself, I started to get involved in youth activity. Youth activity
this
is not.
This was 74.
This was now 79. Up till 84.
Okay.
Because in 85 was an internship, it was impossible to do anything. You had no life. So, so I got involved, but mostly with schools. Teaching them values, school subjects, you know, like importance, all different aspects of living, bring religion into it, and teaching them, like, you know, like guidance, sports, you know, you're learning to get together, having camps. We did a lot of that. And then involved in 1982, I got involved with the Islamic Medical Association. And it had just formed at that stage. And then, of course, after that, we got too busy with internship. And then my mother passed on in 1984. I moved to Pietermaritzburg from Durban. I couldn't get a post to study medicine further. I wanted to do internal medicine to become a physician. No opportunity. Moved to Maritzburg, set up a private practice, which I didn't really want to do, but life has to carry on. And then in 1990, I got involved. And then I left the Islamic Medical Association because I was starting to set up my practice. I got married, kids came. And then in 1990, I got involved with them. When Saddam Hussein invaded Kuwait, projects in Mozambique collapsed, which Kuwait was funding. And Mozambican people asked us for help. So I went across and saw what the needs were, and that's how humanitarian disaster response commenced, not as gift of the givers.
Yes.
And we put up boreholes, we put up medical supplies, we supported the hospital, we gave them food. The following year, 91, was the Gulf War. I set up a nationwide campaign to raise funds to help the victims. And at the same year, I connected DERCO. At that time, it was called Foreign Affairs, DFA, Department of Foreign Affairs. And Mandela was released. De Klerk was trying to shake the hands of people all over the world. And they said, look, they know there's a cyclone in Bangladesh. They know you want to get involved. They'll give us a ship. So they gave us a ship. And through that ship, we went to Bangladesh. And in the process, I had to go to Turkey because we took trucks for the Turkish Red Crescent to deliver aid to Kurdistan. And prior to that date, I met an Afrikaner guy who had come in from America to Maritzburg year I went there, in 1986. Mm-hmm. And he said, and he wanted a doctor. So I became his doctor. And he moved from Pretoria to Maritzburg to teach French at the university. And in the course of my talking to him and treating him, he one day said that he was in America, he was feeling very down, he was walking the streets of New York, and he saw a man in the distance, he doesn't know why, he just followed that man because he was so down, and the man landed up in St. John the Divine, a big church in New York. But when he got there, he realized the man he followed was a Muslim, a Turkish Sufi master. And the man did a zikr ceremony, a Muslim recitation of God's names in the church. And the rabbis, the priests, all who were there, joined the ceremony. It was said it was incredible. And I said, I can't believe this. In any case,
this was a multi-religious thing.
And you know, and people talk about religion being the cause of conflict. And we realize religion is not the cause of conflict. It's people who move away from religion that cause the conflict, who don't follow the rules. And the church elders were intelligent enough, you know, rational enough, or even big-hearted enough to understand the unity of religion. And there's no fear to them, oh, Muslim guys are going to come here and everybody's going to become Muslim. They understood that the God is one, and we're all from the same family. And it was an incredible lesson. And in any case, he tells me, but the real stuff is in Turkey. So I said, what Turkey got to do with this? He said the person who was there, this Muslim Sufi master, is from Turkey. He just visits America. But he passed on in 1985, that man he was talking about. Mm. So I said, then what happens next? So he said, a new one takes over. So he tells me, you need to go to Turkey. And I'm thinking, Miller, when am I ever going to get to Turkey? 1986, I still haven't seen Cape Town. When am I going to see Turkey? And he said, what God wills happens. There's a time and a place. And 91 August, with the delivery of trucks to Turkey, I met the spiritual master. Fell in love with him. What he saw in New York, I saw in Turkey. Christians, Jews, Hindus, Muslims, Americans, Russians, Europeans, people from North America, South America, Africa, Asia, all in the Muslim holy place. Absolute respect. No friction, no discord, understanding each other, love for each other. The overwhelming factor there was love and respect. I fell in love with the teacher.
That is the core of all religions, is that God is love.
Yes.
Yet we distort that.
That's the way when man moves away from religion, that's when you have the conflict. It's not man who follows religion that causes the conflict.
There's more the dogma around religion than the religion itself, isn't
exactly.
it?
Exactly, exactly. And I saw that and I'm impressed. And remember, this was post-Gulf War. And Gulf War left as big, Samuel Huntington at that point spoke of the clash of civilizations. And coming from an apartheid past didn't help. But when you get there, the teacher tells you that mankind is one single nation. The God over mankind is one. We just call him by different names. You shouldn't judge anybody. Don't judge a religion, a group, a nation, a community on the basis of what few people do. You know, and that judging is for God itself. You deal with a person not on the basis of color or race or religion. You deal with a person as a person in his own capacity. And he further went on to say that if people got bad habits, don't talk about the bad habits. Talk about the good things that the person does. And in time, as a law of spirituality, the good will override the bad. Second thing he said is people may have bad habits. It doesn't make them bad people. So quite often they may just have some and nobody's perfect. You know, habits that are not good. And again, you need to encourage the good within that person and you will see that people will change. And he left that philosophy. So he said, when you go out, know the blinkered vision, open-mindedness and embrace everyone. Don't worry about where they came from, which religion, what happened in the past, what the community did. Just deal with the person as a person. And that opened my mind completely. And I went back.
And you had this conversation, you had this as one-on-one conversation with him, or were you a student with him? I mean, what was the
Spiritual teacher, and there's people from everybody engaging him.
Okay.
But he took a liking to me. He took me to his house, and my family to his house. So we had private conversations, because sometimes it was public, Because in a spiritual order, yes, when they're telling you something, actually they mean it for somebody else. So people learn they're disarmed. Because you think it's for you and something's sitting out at you, you put a mental block. But when you say you're talking to somebody else, and the guy will say, you know what, but that applies to me also. But you don't feel embarrassed because they're not talking to you. So it's a spiritual way of teaching in the Sufi spiritual law. That's how they teach. And they mean it for somebody else, but they tell you. And it's a great way of learning. And I've experienced that. Because I set up teaching programs for my medical teams, my search and rescue teams. And when I finish off, they would all come and say, you know what, you spoke that, it helped me with my problem. That's what I'm saying. It gave me a solution for something else. That applied to me. I'll be surprised how many diverse things people come up with, and you're not even thinking about them. So that's the greatness of the spirituality. And that gift sort of came to me from him. Because when I went back on the 6th of August, 1992, I was yearning to see him again. It was a Thursday night, 10 p.m., after a zikr ceremony again. A zikr is a recitation of God's names in Arabic. So that was over. He picks his head up, makes eye contact with me in the other side of the room, and he looks heavenwards at the same time. And then in fluent Turkish, and I don't speak a word of Turkish, but I understood every single word that he said in Turkish. He said, my son, I'm not asking you. I'm instructing you to form an organization. The name in Arabic will be Waqful Waqifin. When we translate it, gift of the givers. It will serve all people of all races, all religions, all colors, all classes, all cultures, of any geographical location and of any political affiliation. But you will serve them unconditionally. You will expect nothing in return, not even a thank you. This is an instruction for you for the rest of your life. Serve people with love, kindness, compassion, and mercy, and remember the dignity of man is foremost. Clothe the naked, feed the hungry, provide water to the thirsty, and in everything that you do, be the best at what you do. Not because of ego, but because you're dealing with human life, human emotion, human dignity. My son, remember that whatever you do is done through you and not by you. There is no place for ego.
So that was a direct prophecy that was delivered to you by this master.
I didn't understand at that point. And then after that, at some point, I asked him, how is it that when you speak Turkish, I understand? And other people speak Turkish, I don't understand. And he said, my son, when the hearts connect and the souls connect, the words become understandable. I asked him, what exactly am I supposed to do? And when am I supposed to do what you want me to do? Because I'm a doctor in private practice. I have 3 surgeries in a place called Pietermaritzburg in South Africa. He told me one line. You will know. For 30 years I do know. What to do, how to do, what to touch, what not to touch. In fact, the moment I walked out of that place, the same night, it came to me, respond to the civil war in Bosnia. The same month, I took in 32 containers of aid into Bosnia. In November, I took another 8 containers of winter stuff in Bosnia. In 1993, we designed the world's first containerized mobile hospital, a product of South African engineering, South African technology, built in Africa, in South Africa, taken from Africa into Europe. And when CNN filmed the hospital, they said the South African containerized mobile hospital is equal to any of the best hospitals in Europe. And I then understood. August 92, November 92, 1993, 3 in a row, all disaster-related projects. He said, you will know. I then understood that Gift of the Givers, in essence, was going to be a disaster response agency nationally and internationally. And everything that follows around that will still be based around disasters. We have 21 different categories of projects which we design over our 30-year history.
So just in terms of, because I mean, often in this podcast, we have young people listening to it. And so if I listen to you, you always had the fertile ground in you in terms of this. You had the need to serve people. You went to study medicine and then you had the spiritual experience.
On that same point, when the spiritual teacher met me for the first time, he told me, in your soul, I see someone who likes to help people.
Yeah. And around the millennials. But one thing that I see in them is a willingness to live and let live and to help. So if I have to take it back to your example, and so you were yearning for a direction, you were faithful and following the yearning that you felt in your soul, and at one point there was this intervention. And what age was that?
30.
So you were 30. So if you've prepared yourself for this moment, and then that was then delivered to you, and then you reacted on it. And like you said, then after that you knew what to do and where to go.
Yes. In every project, I just know things are put in front of me. I know what to do. I mean, let's take a hostage situation. My guy calls me from Yemen, and he says there's a South African couple taken hostage here by we're not sure if it's Al-Qaeda or who, but somebody's taken hostage. What must we do? I said, let's negotiate. We have no experience in hostage negotiations. And I said, I'm about to say it's best among people are those who benefit mankind. To me, we're benefiting mankind. It fits the criteria. Let's just do it. And then it comes. You know, this is how you should do it. Meet the guys, announce you want to see them, but they find you, you don't find them. And eventually we made contact, and within 4 days of contact, we got Yolande Kocke released at no cost, no ransom. Amazing. And that was, we just knew step by step what to do next. No book, no teaching, no training. We just knew what to do.
Yeah.
And even when the disasters we go, we just know from the beginning when we get there, you're going to do this, that, and the other. It just comes to you.
So I mean, you're from that point, you obviously had to start to build an organization that supports you in all of that. So from the point where you now received it and you sort of went into Bosnia, I would imagine at that stage it was basically you and maybe one or two supporters.
One person. Well, it wasn't one person then. When I started off, the office started in my kid's room. 12 square meters. It was a kid's room, but a double bunk. We put in a fax machine and the toys were all in that room because I didn't have a big house. And of course, my wife, my father-in-law, my brother-in-law, and the family started supporting us. And I took my own money. So we started off with our own money. We started small. And then because I had done the Mozambique project and because I had done the Gulf War,
yes,
the Muslim community knew me and getting to know me a little more. And the advantage of that is as Muslims, as part of the religion, charity is an integral part of the religion. That if you don't give charity, God is not interested in you.
Yeah.
So we don't have to ask people to take out money. They know they got to take out money. But what they need to know is which cause they want to support. That's the only criteria. But taking out is no option. You got to take it out. So the Bosnia project was resonating with the people. And in time, as the projects grew and we went to more areas, more people started funding. But the turnaround came. We got the breakthrough from other communities and other religions when the media started traveling with us.
Mm.
And then the public realized this got nothing to do with religion. It's got to do with humanity because the teams that travel are mixed from different races and religions.
And that's your philosophy.
Yes, but that's its Islamic teaching in any case. They know that you look at mankind, the Islamic word that used, the Prophet was sent as a mercy to mankind, not Muslim. In fact, it was sent as a mercy to all creation. So plant, animal, universe, everything. So that is Islamic teaching. And that God is one, mankind is one, and you know, you treat everybody equally. You show respect and love to all religions, everything. There was one example. There was a Jewish funeral taking place. And as the funeral came past, the Prophet instructed everybody to stand and to respect the funeral. No matter what the religion was, it's a funeral. It's a person, it's a human, you got to respect it. And he's taught lots of values and principles like that. So that same principle we applied. And the teams together, we're interested in social cohesion, in working together, because collectively, with the best talent, we can make a huge difference to people's lives. And that's the essence of religion. Sacrificing, serving, healing, helping, assisting. It's not about prayer. Prayer is not the end in itself. It's to prepare you to do all these other things. That's the purpose of prayer. And the spiritual teacher told me, he said, it's time to sit in the corner and pray is gone. The world needs help. We need to go out. Forget about praying in the corner. Get up and get the job done. Doesn't mean you must neglect your prayer.
God will help those who want to help themselves.
Yes. So it was an important principle. And then the media traveled with us. And you know, our missions just started getting bigger and bigger. We started off with tents, blankets, medicines, sanitary pads, diapers, energy biscuits, bottled water. And then we extended for the first time in 2004. We had primary healthcare teams. And then in 2005, with the earthquake in Pakistan, we had trauma teams and primary healthcare teams and post-op rehab. And then eventually we brought in trauma counselors. And for the earthquake in Haiti, we then for the first time had our own search and rescue teams. And that was a world first what we achieved there. 8 days after the earthquake, we pulled somebody out of the rubble alive. It never happened before that an African team pulled out somebody from the rubble alive in an earthquake outside the African continent. We were the first guys to do that. And
with this device
device came later.
Okay.
We learned about this device whilst we were there.
Okay.
Right. And then we did that, and then search and rescue. Then we added on dogs. In Mozambique, we added on helicopters. And of course, in Yemen came the hostage negotiation story. We are the most complete disaster team in the world. Nobody does what we do.
And why are you now starting to operate across continents as well?
Well, we've always been doing that.
Okay.
Since 92.
Yeah. And your first one was Bosnia.
We've helped 45 countries.
But you're South African based. You don't have satellite offices around other parts of the world.
We have.
Or you have
not. We have. But we know it's very controlled because I have offices from which I can move to other parts of the world.
Okay.
But over the years, I have South Africans who've moved across. So I've got guys based in Netherlands. And of course, some are not South Africans. They are people who joined us while you're on a mission.
Yes.
So we got guys in Denmark, in Australia, in Kenya, in Holland. And if you need somebody to say, okay, the disaster is closest to you, you go first kind of stuff, we'll follow afterwards. And that network is growing. The other thing that has happened since COVID, because we helped 210 hospitals nationwide in South Africa, there's a far bigger list of people, medical people, wanting to join our teams. In fact, I think in Cape Town alone, we probably got 300 to 400 volunteers already. We had a meeting in the same room where you're interviewing me now last night. And the president of the Anesthetic Society came last night. Mm-hmm. And she said, all the anesthetists are available to you whenever you want them. When you help Charlotte Mekeke Hospital, the head of department came and said, all the intensivists and ICU specialists are available for you whenever you want them. When you assisted Khankuwa, Kalafong Hospital in Khankuwa in Madunsa, the head of department of surgery said, whenever you need any surgeons, they're all available for you. That is one aspect. Then we started getting calls from Africa. Botswana, Zimbabwe, Kenya, Uganda. Please, can we join your guys' teams when you go out? And we're thinking, how the hell are we going to fit all these people in? And then even better than that, Australia, New Zealand, Hong Kong, parts of Europe, Canada, America, UK. Please, when you guys go, can our teams join you guys?
So you've really captured the hearts and the imaginations of all people in terms of the humanitarian work.
Yes, and they've seen the skill of our teams. And remember, it's important to emphasize that these people who got the skills went to preschool, primary school, secondary school, and university in this country. It's not something from outside. And we need to understand as a nation that we need to be proud about that. And that when you go out, be purely South African from birth, right till the time we intervene. And the impact we've made is all of them have trained in South Africa. They all work in South Africa. They live in South Africa.
So the core of gift and the givers is South African.
100% South African. It's only when we go to another country, we don't know the culture. We don't know the goings on. It's pointless putting somebody else in that country when you got their own people to do that.
Yeah.
So as a policy, I don't send any South African to work in a country outside South Africa. Everything's homegrown. Because like I understand South Africa, they can't come and teach me about South Africa.
Yes.
I can't teach them about their country. So it's the same policy we apply. But we give them the backup. We give them support.
But the core of your team is based here.
The whole team is based here.
Okay.
Yeah.
You've now hit, I think, so you're 30 years old or just over 30 years old now. You've dispersed, and it's always difficult to put a value on it, 3.84 billion.
No, it's just past 5 billion now.
5 billion rand.
Yes. We had dollars and pounds. Yeah. Our economy is in rands.
Well, soon, hopefully, you'll get to that number in dollars and pounds. So, I mean, your approach to leadership. So you have these volunteers. Obviously, they need to be led. You have a very spiritual inclination in terms of how you go about this. But how do you approach leadership? How do you approach leadership in these? Because these are high pressure, high risk situations. What is your philosophy around, because you are one man and the only way for you to have an impact is to empower your leadership team. And what is your approach towards that?
It's very simple. I can't make people do something that I myself don't do. So the number one is to set is by example. So in a war zone, I go first. I go alone
okay.
to see what's going on. Initially, I used to go alone. And because I had no teams. The first teams only came in 2004. So we had no team before that. So it was for 2004 when the first intervention came. Because before I went to war zones, there was no team. So I went alone. But when we decided to take teams, then one person would come or two people would come. And the way the team started is, I'm a doctor, so I got a couple of friends here. But actually, it wasn't my close friends. It was the guys that I met who were also involved in some other stuff, and we became friends. And somehow when I said, I think I'm taking a team, the other guy said, okay, I think I'm going to join you. I got these two friends. I know them well. I don't know them. They're going to come. So we started like five or six people. You go out, there's a spiritual feeling. The spiritual impact is there. It touches the soul. When the media started traveling with us, they tell us, when we travel with you guys, we find God. You know what? It's just something special. You want to come with you all the time. So they write about what they saw. The guys who experienced what they saw come back and tell their friends. Now suddenly from seven, you got 20 people who want to come with you next time. But now we don't need 20 primary health care people. We need trauma medicine people. But we didn't have trauma medicine the first time. So somebody else comes, the Pakistan earthquake. There we need trauma medicine. Pakistani doctors living in South Africa said, we know the country. We want to help our own people. We're joining you. So we brought in another element that when we go to a country that's of course, a different nationality, we try to take people of that country. And South Africa got everybody, you know, or they speak that language or find somebody who can join us. So I go, I set an example, you know, we make sure the hotels and everything are going well. And then eventually I identify, okay, this guy came for the first time, absolutely good in admin, team management, IT. I start with put them in charge of different teams. And as they get in charge over a period of time, they get bigger responsibility. They're allowed to do things for themselves. And like this function last night, the Western Cape health guy came with me many years ago. And once you give them responsibility, you allow them to come up with their own ideas. You tell them this is what you want. And along the line, they said, I did this, that, the other. And I tell them, just change this one aspect. And even they're going to make mistakes. As long as it's not reputational damage, I leave them. Because that's the best way you're going to learn. And that's the same rule apply not only to my medical teams, to even my staff. I tell them, go in the field, you on the ground directly. You sing better than us. You know what's going on. What do you suggest? And they will come up with certain ideas.
So you allow them to be the leaders that they want to be in this, in touching humanity.
Yes. And they come up with some fantastic stuff. To the point now that the way we've grown in 2019, the local South African non-medical teams responded to the floods in Durban, and the medical and search and rescue teams responded to Cyclone Idai in Mozambique, Malawi, and Zimbabwe at the same time. We're in four crises at the same time, and we had different teams doing all the different things at the same time, because it's not only during the mission. Outside the mission, we have gatherings, we have discussions, we have a chat group that's on 365 days a year. During COVID, we advise each other. We meet, we discuss, we come up on new ideas, new machines. These are more portable. Put the big machines away. It's pointless carrying those heavy things. Now there's a new portable design. Let's use this. This is a new technology, new development. I don't practice medicine. So I'm dependent on my guys who are skilled in those fields with all the new technology, all the new skills, all the new techniques. And when we go across, we teach each other. And we teach the people we're going out. So transfer of skills is critical. We started outreach programs in South Africa for the first time, where we went to Tosafir in February last year to do a medical outreach camp. Teeth, eyes, ears, nose, body, everything. We did a similar one in September. In November, we got called by Kimberley Hospital. The head surgeon is one of my team members. And he says, I need to catch up surgery. COVID has put me behind. I don't have enough scripts of sisters. I don't have enough anesthetists. Can you help? I put it on the chat. Within 5 minutes, I got like a whole army of people wanting to go. So he said he only needs five scrub sisters and five anesthetists. 48 hours later, they're there. In 60 hours, we wipe out 71 operations. And last night's team was now not only gift of the givers. We got partnership projects in Groteskier, Victoria Hospital, Helderberg, Tigerberg, and Vincent Pallotti, dialysis programs, the Poison Center we're funding after hours, Red Cross Hospital, and all the different teams then came and spoke. And suddenly, everybody realized the amount of medical work taking place. And whoever came here last night had a great spiritual feeling, a feeling of hope, a feeling of wanting to serve. But all the skills, the public sector is in trouble. and they are dedicated to their patients. So you empower them, you support them, you encourage them. During the COVID itself, we used to go and visit them and, you know, give them a pamper, a pack, something to pamper them. They can afford it. They earn big money in the hospital. But coming from outside to say somebody recognizes what you guys do, this was a real boost of morale for so many people. And we've maintained the relationship from March 2020. And I go, no crisis, I just go and visit hospitals.
I mean, if you look at the South African medical, public medical system, I mean, that is a crisis in itself at the moment, because we are not delivering the basic healthcare that we should be delivering. We are not managing our healthcare system, and in many cases the funding is lacking. So listening to you, it almost sounds like this is an ongoing crisis that you...
Yes, it's a long-term process. And the health is something we're focusing, because COVID taught the whole country that you can have all the money in the world, but if there's no ICU bed and no oxygen, you're going to die with your 2 billion rand outside the door of the hospital. And people realize how important health is. And we capitalized on that and said, let's... And then we brought the corporates in. I said, you guys understood now. Your own family couldn't make it to the hospital. Healthcare needs support. And they've been very, very generous. Corporates have bought into the idea. Hospitals need infrastructure upgrade, which we're doing. Hospital needs boreholes because of the water and the load shedding and all other issues and the drought, supporting that. Some hospitals need additional staff, which we're paying for, paramedics and nurses. Then, of course, during COVID, it was PPEs, CPAP machines, high-flow nasal oxygen machines, video laryngoscopes, triage tents on the outside, equipment, supplies, scrubs, surgical overalls, all that was paid for, testing teams, testing kits. We put up 10 mobile testing teams, you know, that went throughout the country. They even tested all the soccer teams and the cricket teams and the rugby teams, you know, for mass, any mass companies, 5, 6, 7 other people at a time before COVID. So they got involved in that. And now we're saying, like, okay, guys come from Tigerberg. We got a dialysis program. We can't fit everybody in. Vincent Pelote then comes in and said, we'll give you less than half the rate that we normally charge. We said, okay, we'll fund it. We funded 16 dialysis patients last year. They could do only 2 or 3. We did 16 in the first year alone already. And then Red Cross Hospital calls and said, the poison center is shutting down. After hours, we get thousands of calls. Certain person got a snake bite, a spider bite, took ingested TB drugs, kid took some father's medicine. Nobody to advise them. I funded the whole program after hours, 130,000 in a month. Said, okay, let's fund that. It's saving health, saving lives. And avoiding many other things, catch-up surgery with rotoscopy, catch-up surgery with cataracts, huge cataracts demand in the country to catch-up surgery. Many hospitals are calling for that now. Infrastructure upgrade, boreholes, equipment, catch-up surgery. But the most important part in terms of the health, and then a lot of hospitals had no food for the patients, which we supplied. But the most important to me, the single most important intervention in health right now is to fund registrars. Governments made it clear they don't have any money. And they don't have money, it's true. And even if they were not, they didn't have the corruption and the state capture, 7.4 million people, Texas can't look after 65 million people. It's impossible, no matter who the government was, or from which country. So the private sector has to hold hands with government till we can fix the system. Mm. And I'm making a call to corporates, as I made a call last night, and I've been speaking to corporates and to the mines. I said, look, we're going to do this for the public, not for the government. I need your support for 4 years. 1.2 million rand a year per registrar. That's the fee that they get if the government pays them. We need to pay them for 4 years. The registrar would become a specialist. If we don't have specialists, the quality of our medicine is going to fall apart. Mm. And the registrar doesn't only become a specialist, he trains the students below him. So there'll be no teaching for students below. So what kind of doctors are we going to produce? So 1.2 million over 4 years, but I want to fund 500 registrars, which will go to the academic hospitals in all the disciplines. Neurology, internal medicine, ophthalmology, ENT, gynecology, orthopedics, dermatology, general surgery, the works. And we put them only in academic hospitals because the registrar only works in an academic hospital. But we'll put a condition that once a month, you will go to an outside hospital and see those people and give them skills. The medical guys will give skills to, the patients will use your skills on them. And when you qualify, you can't go into private sector for 2 or 3 years.
Okay, so that's giving back.
You're giving back.
So this is the call that you're putting out, yes. And we will put it out on the podcast as well and on the social media. So the call is from corporates, individuals, is we want to fund 500 registrars.
Yes.
for a period of four years.
Perth registrar. At a cost of 1.2 million.
1.2 million.
Each.
Each.
Yeah. So it's sometimes 900,000, yep. Some are 1 million. But let's say over 4 years, there'll be inflation. So just say 1.2 million per year over 4 years.
So we'll put that out. I mean, what is amazing for me about just listening to you is it's not these lofty plans and lofty ideas. You are involved on ground level boreholes.
PPE. It's all practical stuff.
It's all practical stuff. You basically need to volunteer your time in order to assist this movement that's started to deliver practical things on a day-to-day basis to people who need it.
You're from a company that does investment. You guys look for returns. Okay? The business people look for returns. One registrar can see 30 patients a day. That's 360 times 30. You work 7 days a week. You're talking over 1,000 patients. But it's not colds and flus. It's serious cases, liver conditions, lung conditions, kidney conditions, heart conditions. It's very serious medicine. To look after 1,000 patients for 1.2 million with that condition, the returns is, you know, there's no limit to that.
It's exponential.
Yes. What we need to understand is we could have been one of those 1,000 patients because inevitably from everybody who's listening here, there are family members who don't have medical aid. Yes. Who don't have medical insurance, and you can't afford to put them on your medical aid because it's too expensive. So they go into the public service. So you're actually doing your own family, your own neighbors, your own community a favor by upgrading the public health sector.
And if you expand on that, your employees, the economic growth, that you, if you have a business, it's healthy employees, happy employees. This is the fiber of society, really,
yes.
At the end of the day.
And while speaking our intervention is huge. And I've been engaging Board of Healthcare Funders, medical aid schemes, private hospital groups, you know, and saying, okay, the NHI, the way the government is envisioning it, it's not going to work. No. And I say they got delusions of grandeur. It's not going to work. The hospitals are falling apart. But they are right in that we need a national health plan. That I support totally. But the way they look at it, I have a problem with that. If 8.9 million people are already on private medical aid and they're not complaining and the companies are not complaining, why do you need to take the burden of those people and bring them back to government when you can't look after the ones that are already there? I would say send it the other way around. Send another 9 million the other way. And I spoke to the medical aids and they said there are packages, there are plans. We can absorb another 9 million people into private healthcare, especially for the hospital plan, because that's where the biggest problem is. And we can have specialized packages. We just need some buy-in from those companies that haven't put their employees on medical aid, and it's not that expensive. We can tailor-made the packages. Then I speak to the private hospitals, and I say, if you reduce your rate, the medical aid can reduce their rate, and the contributions becomes less, and more people can buy into the system.
Yeah.
But for that to happen, for the private hospital to reduce their rate, the guys that sell them the consumables, the equipment, they need to reduce their rate. And the doctors who charge 300 to 400% of medical aid rates need to come down to be at more reasonable level. This is medicine. This is not commerce. It's about life and health. So if they do that, if we all do that in the chain,
yes,
then not only will have 20 million people on private healthcare, but people who are not on medical aid, but they need some procedure. They say, okay, it's reasonable. It's 30,000 rand. My son will give me 5,000 rand. My wife will give me 4,000 rand. My uncle will give me 8,000 rand. And between us, we'll pay for the bill. We won't have to go to the public sector. And a lot of people will do that. And a lot of people are doing that right now already. So you now take the burden of 20 million people off the system.
Yeah.
And then the other part is to upgrade the hospitals. Government doesn't have the money. We pay for the registrars. And then we pay for the hospital upgrades and the catch-up surgery, which corporate South Africa is already doing. Give government 4 years. Fix your nonsense in 4 years. Your state capture, the money is lost. Catch the people. Get the money back. Let the economy grow. Let the tax base grow. After 4 years, you start running the country the way it should be run.
And that, I think, is a fantastic plan. And it comes back to business, people in the street, doctors. It's creating a virtuous cycle again. I mean, the great thing that I am picking up in South Africa is that, given, and we're going to talk a little bit about the rest of the world, given the problems in the rest of the world, we realize what we have here is a phenomenal country with people that are resilient. It's a beautiful country. It's got more than enough resources to have a thriving population and economy. It really is about just getting involved again. And what I'm picking up in the last 6 months to a year, specifically post-COVID, is that there's so many problems everywhere. Fix what we have. Fix what you know on this side.
If you sat here last night, you would see the hope that came out in this country. And to me, The best thing about South Africans is a lot of these people are highly qualified. The one guy is the only ophthalmic oncologist in the country. If he drops dead, there is nobody else. He wants to train other people at the headquarters here. The other guy is one of three in South Africa that does endometriosis endoscopy in the country. There's only three of them. And these are the kind of guys who can go in the private sector and make millions. And they train, and the one guy who does the endometriosis endoscopy, it's a human problem, is one of the guys that manages the robot in Tigerberg Hospital, robotic surgery. Now, these are the skilled guys who can walk out and make millions in the private sector. And I've got lady doctors, friends, who came out of the government hospitals to study for a whole year, get a PhD, specialize in the subject, and I said, now you're going to the private sector. They said, we didn't come here to get a degree to go to the private sector. We got a degree to go back to help the people that need us most. And when you see that kind of spirit, when you see that kind of commitment, there's an outsider's. You have to support that commitment. Yes. You can't leave them in the lurch. You know, and that's why I take on government systems, because the CEO is causing nonsense, the head of the department is causing nonsense. I go for them. Because you are making life difficult for somebody who's serving the people that you should be serving.
Yes.
And the red tape and bureaucracy has to be broken, and we specialize in that.
Yeah. I think that is a worthy cause to put for everyone to put the business as well as any individual to put their effort behind. I want to maybe just move a little bit closer to you on the one hand, because I mean your spirit around these things are contagious. I mean, you've seen your fair share of trauma and of man inflicting pain on man. To the end, I mean, I think you probably can tell stories that we probably cannot broadcast on this podcast. So you've seen it all. How do you, as a human being, and I know you had this the spiritual calling to do what you do, but we're all human. If we're exposed to this kind of evil on a regular basis, because that's what you do, is you put yourself between the evil of man inflicting absolute evil on man and the solution. How do you keep that enthusiasm, and how do you not get disillusioned by the nature of man and but what's going on in this world and the trauma that you have to deal with?
Again, it's a very religious type of thing, where we are told that good always overrides the bad, that there are more good people than bad people. And then the same thing I said at the beginning, when people do the bad, you guide them to get to the right path. Many do, many don't. But their behavior doesn't put me down. It actually gives me the strength and the spirit to go and help those people who are in difficulty. And the spirit of those people that have suffered, the way they embrace it, you know, again, it's based on faith. And they say, we know God has given us this challenge and our faith in God is increased. And they're patient. Let's take an example. This sounds very in the air. Let me tell you, give a tangible example. I go into Syria in December 2012. I don't want a guy that doesn't like cold weather. It's freezing there. I got two jackets on, jerseys, two pants. I got six blankets over me, and I sleep with my shoes on, and I'm still freezing. I'm not a guy that can take cold weather. I go into the camp. There's this 8-year-old child walking only with a panty, barefooted. It rains in Syria in December like how it rains in Cape Town in the winter. It's this winter. The rain is coming through the tent on the top because it's very porous. And this child comes to me with a bowl of olives. So I asked my host, what am I supposed to do? He said, you're supposed to eat it. So I said, but there's no food here. How can I eat this child's olives? He said, that's not your problem. You're the guest. The tradition is the guest, the host gives you something and you got to eat this. I said, but it's a child's food. I just cannot eat this. He said, you have to eat it. Otherwise you'll be insulting the child. So I take this olive and I can't swallow it. Because I'm thinking now, I'm eating this child's food. So I see this cruelness. I see the parents killed. I see the family killed. I see the bodies everywhere. I see hospitals, ambulances, doctors, medical facilities bombed. But I see the spirit of this child and the nation wanting to give. I go to Yemen. It's Ramadan. BBC said there's famine in the country. So I went to and check. I can't find any kids with famine. By evening, I went through about 20 villages already. Me and one of my team members. At prayer time, it's Ramadan, you have to break the fast. Suddenly at prayer time, this lady is screaming like crazy in the street. So I asked my host, Why is this lady screaming like this? She said, she's fighting with all the people in the street that they can't take you to eat, to break your fast. You are going to be her guest. I said, but the lady got nothing. He said, that's how they are. And there's no lights. Because there's load shedding. It's not load shedding. They just don't have electricity. And then you go in the house, and in the dark, she's going to create the impression that she's eating and give you whatever she has in the house. I said, you know what? It's Ramadan. You have to be extra conscious about your behavior. Now, I got a choice of eating somebody else's food or lying. I decided to lie. I said, you know, God, we'll do this later on. Right now, I'm going to lie. Just tell a lady that somebody else invited me before she invited me, so I really cannot go to a house to eat. And he had to tell her that. In that spirit, and then it struck me, we didn't see any child with famine. But we didn't see any food in any of the houses that we went to. There was no fridge, no stove, no cupboard, no mattress, no blanket. These people had nothing. We're looking for the famine, and in the process, we only afterwards, when I reflected, I realized, hey, I missed something so big that nobody had anything in any of the houses. And in spite of that having nothing, they came forward to share what they didn't have. You know, when you see that, and when you ask the teams, they will tell you, when we go, we don't give, we receive. Because the warmth of the people, the generosity, the love, and when you do something, you just need to look at the eyes. The eyes talk a million words. And you can see that thankfulness that God sent somebody to help us. And that's priceless. We go to East King at King Williamstown at night. And it's about sunset. And the green truck is coming. Our trucks are green. As they're walking in, my team's on the ground. A lady on crutches, old lady, picks up her hands. And she looks upwards and she said, you didn't let me down. I pray to you and you send the green people. I know you won't let me down. And it's that kind of stuff that just encourages us to go over and over again. When we pull a lady out of the rubble in Haiti, her first words were, I love God Almighty. You instill hope in somebody several thousand kilometers away. I got some people who don't have any faith. When I say faith, I don't mean in a negative way. They're not sure what they believe in, or they don't believe in anything. But they know there's some goodness in the world. And they tell me, when we travel with you, we find God. We find peace. And we want to travel with you all the time. And these are journalists. And the medical guys who come from expensive homes, 4 cars each, 10, 15 million rand homes, sleep in the street, sewage, no water, no shelter, shooting in the streets, bombs flying around, and they are the guys that put up their hand first because there's something that they feel that you can't explain.
So it's a calling outside of yourself. It's a calling outside of, and that transcends what you see. And you see that.
And the other thing, of course, that's on the one side. The other side, of course, I teach my teams emotional distancing. Guys heard of social distancing for the first time and physical distancing. I mean teaching emotional distancing.
Yeah, because you cannot absorb this.
You can't be attached to the situation. And I tell him, when you go in, please don't say that this child's leg is blown off or this child got no sight and that old man can't walk. Please don't do that.
So you prepare them for that.
I prepare, but it doesn't always work.
It is traumatic for those who goes into those situations. Barring the people that's in them, but the people coming going to deliver the aid must also be traumatized.
And I tried to train, but now and next we haven't done any outreach programs since COVID, but before COVID came, after the last mission, we said we're going to take trauma counselors, not for the people, but for the teams.
Okay, so
because secondary traumatization is an issue, but doctors are generally macho. No, we're fine. We don't need anything. Nothing happens to us. But for the first time, if you look at the medical chats during COVID, never before in the history of this country have doctors asked for mental health support as much as they asked during COVID, the civil unrest, the floods, job losses, unemployment. They've been asking, is there somebody who teaches yoga? Is there somebody who teaches mindfulness? Can you recommend a good psychologist, a good psychiatrist? What exercise can we do? What medication can we use? Is there some herbal stuff we can use for the mind? What do we do for depression? Is there any prayer? It's those kind of things, all different modalities, anything to take the stress and anxiety away. And it's more and more. And the fact that they've owned up to that is maturity because they felt they were macho and they don't need it. And when we go across, even though the team said they don't need it, you'll see after hours, in a war zone or earthquake, they'll start unwinding. They'll say stupid things. They'll joke. They'll laugh at each other. They'll say silly things. And you feel this is how they're unwinding. They're letting out what's inside. And you've got two or three guys who are very good at counseling. And it just so happens. And of course, with that, the team spirit gets stronger. Yes. They bind with each other even better.
So it's an interesting point. I mean, you say that for the first time that is starting to come through, because we're picking up in our businesses. I mean, I'm involved with one or two charities, that the level of anxiety and stress has never been higher, and the level of mental illness has never been higher. I mean, why would I mean, if you have to take a temperature check on all of this in terms of where the world's going, and also then broader than that, I mean, 10 years ago you would have said, you know, war is becoming something of the past. Yet we are now at a point where we are in so many parts of the world looking at real crisis. There's again a nuclear threat on the table. So, I mean, if you have to take a temperature check of humanity and where we are we getting better at what, you know, at dealing with each other? I mean, is war and famine and disaster something that's been with us for millennia and will stay with us for millennia? I mean, what would you?
To me, when crisis come, it's an educational process. A lot of people who went through the crisis with COVID, the nuclear threat in Europe, haven't had that kind of experience in a long time. And it's been happening in Africa, in the Middle East, and other parts of the world. And when people have their own kind of experience, like the Ukraine, let's take Ukraine for example. We supporting Ukraine, you know, in a big way. And we train them how to deal with their own situation. And they learned overnight. I was with them again 2 nights ago. And they said, you know, we never expect this to happen in Europe. And now there's no gas, and there's no electricity, and there's no oil, and the threat of nuclear weapons can come across. And they now understand the difficulty of people all over that has happened in the past in other countries. And the compassion and the humanity is increasing. If you look at Corporate South Africa wasn't really interested in CSI, let's be honest. CSI was something because the government said that. You didn't feel about that. The first question is, how many BE points? Will you get a tax certificate? Will we get some publicity in the media? They were interested in that. But something changed. When COVID came, for the first time, I saw compassion in commercialization, where Corporate South Africa, not the CSI, the CEO, called and says, forget about all those things. Just tell me how much you need and how can you save the country and how can you save the people. When the civil analysts came in KZN, the first guys that called were the guys who lost everything in that part. Of course, they got other companies and other head offices everywhere else. Their warehouse is gone, their shop is gone, company is gone. But they're the ones who called first and said, what do you need? How can we help? There was no vengeance, no anger, no hatred. When the floods came, 11 April 2022 is going to be a day I'm never going to forget. At 5:30, the water rose 8 meters in 45 minutes and people were getting washed away. And I'm expecting people to say, please send a helicopter, send a boat, send a diver, send earth moving equipment. The wall fell down on my child. We don't know where the child is. Please send that. Nobody called. The only guys that called till 1 a.m. was Corporate South Africa, CEOs. And they said, can we help? So I said, are you guys feeling well? So they said, what do you mean? I said, since when in your life did you guys stay up at night to give away money? They said, we learned from COVID. We've learned about hardship and difficulty. We've seen it in our own families. How much do you need and what do you need?
But there is an awareness developing.
And as something else happened, the people were agnostics. People had no faith. When I say no faith, I don't mean in a negative way. They didn't know what to believe or not to believe. I don't mean it in a negative sense. We're not here to judge anybody. And then people who said, look, we didn't know. And I was dealing with professors and scientists. I did a lot of talks and discussions. And they would say, you know what? We need to look at the world differently. There is something different here. There is another force. We need to embrace that. And
there's an enlightenment.
Enlightenment and awareness and a willingness to look differently. Not I'm fixed it, I'm not going to think anything different. A willingness to look differently. And that to me was very, very encouraging. And all those kind of things, we always say as a religious point, that when you have difficulty and hardship, if you reflect correctly, it makes you better. And I've seen in war zones, in earthquakes, how people pick themselves up. Two things happen. One group of people become absolute monsters because they have power, ego, and greed, and the prices should shoot from 1 rand to 1,000 rand for the same thing. And you have another group of people who will, in Kosovo, this man who's standing in the bread queue, he said, I'm a multimillionaire. I've lost everything in the war. But I got money outside. I'm going outside to fetch that money, and I'm bringing it back here to give out to all these people. And that's the kind of spirit that, you know, that makes you think the beauty of mankind. In other areas, during the floods itself and, you know, civil unrest, multimillionaires couldn't get bread. And ordinary people took bread and were distributing it to rich people and middle-class people and poor people. And the rich people say, we'll pay for it. You come to communities, all rich people, loving God, mega houses. One guy takes out the money and buys the bread and milk from where you can get it and shares it with everybody, and in the informal settlement also. And they say, don't worry about the money. It's fine. We can all afford it, you know, kind of stuff. And you see that kind of spirit where people want to give each other.
So we're joining mankind again. We sort of separated from it, and we sort of, COVID taught us that we are all very fragile.
Yes.
And that we are dependent on each other in terms of not only physical survival, but also spiritual survival.
And on the same basis, that the only way to build this country is together. Yes. No other way. And by together, I mean including government. When we say government is corrupt, like the teacher said, don't paint everybody with the same brush.
There are some corrupt.
Some corrupt. There's a lot of good guys in government. The problem is they don't have the skills. That's the first thing. Secondly, a lot of them have the wrong advisors. And thirdly, they got the pressure from their own parties. So we need to change all that. And eventually, what we say government, political party, corporate, those are all entities. What makes up those entities is individuals. You fix the individual, you fix the system. There's four critical elements that South Africans and the world need. Spirituality, morality, values, and ethics. We need to go back to the great 3-year-olds, and from there upwards to go to the 104-year-olds to change the system within government. If we do that, we won't have to worry about money, about what's being stolen, because you'll be your own policeman.
Yeah. And to your point, get involved in the basics and get involved in things where you have that exponential return on investment, whether it's time or money. Your example around the specialists.
Yes,
I know you're pressed for time, and I know you need to catch a plane to your next destination. So I want to. It's maybe a good place to close it. My favorite quote that you mentioned actually earlier in our conversation as well, and maybe to close on this, is remember that whatever you do is done through you, not by you. And if we take that challenge that you've put out there, and if we assimilate,
I would expand on that.
Yeah.
In the present context, what destroys government, society, systems, businesses, communities, and families is one word. It's called ego. And we have to break that ego. I call ego a monster, a terrorist, an extremist, you know, a destructive agent that destroys everything. And a lot of what we see in government now is because of egos of people. And that's destroying the country. And the teacher was right from the beginning. You have to put everything else before yourself. And if we do that, actually, you'll benefit more than by trying to be this boss and trying to accumulate everything for yourself. And on that same point, we have a teaching. What you don't use is not yours. So if I decide today, I got a lot of money, I'm going to give everybody in South Africa 2 billion rand. Please tell me how many lifetimes you're going to need to spend that money. You're going to go mad trying to know how to spend that money. You can buy 5 houses, 100 million in each, but how many rooms can you sleep in? Who's going to clean all that stuff? You can buy expensive cars, but it gets broken down. Then you could put a new battery, fix the tie. It's all a headache. Rather, take the money and share what you can. I had a guy from a big estate agency. He said, I want to give you a lot of my estate money. So I said, what about your children? He said, how much more are you going to spend? They got enough. I'd rather die knowing that I've done some good in this world. You know, I go with the blessings. My kids don't need. And I've heard it from so many people. My kids don't need it. I was in Turkey. I met somebody. I know the lady for a long time. She's part of the spiritual order. She calls me. She said, I've made money over the years with apartments. I want to give you my apartments. So I said, what about your son? She said, my son's got enough. What you worried about him for? He doesn't need mine. And you're getting that same kind of sentiment everywhere. People are understanding that to share is of more value than to give everything to your kids, who won't understand the value of what you build. And quite often it's blown overnight. and they don't respect what's given to them. And when you build your kids, give them education, give them values, spirituality, morality, values, and ethics, they will look after themselves. Yes, you're going to leave something for a house, for a car, for medical aid, for food, for education. Yes, you must do all that. But by far and large, better to share. Because whatever money you don't spend is not yours.
Dr. Imtiaz Suleiman, your spirit is contagious, and the work that you're doing is phenomenal. We thank you for that. I personally thank you for that, and South Africa thanks you for that, and setting the example that you are setting. We will post all of the various links, anyone who wants to get involved with your cause. But thank you, and thank you for being faithful to that prophecy that you received. And we wish you all the best in all the various important endeavors that you're busy with.
Thank you very much. And so to South Africans, one message, don't look at big things. Just be realistic. We have a teaching, whoever sees an atom's weight of good, whoever does an atom's weight of good shall see it. So don't look for big things. Help your neighbor, your children, your friend, guy in the company down the road. Don't look for big things. It's sometimes the smallest things that make the biggest difference.
Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
Season 2 is brought to you by Exayo Capital. Exayo Capital is a leading private equity fund manager that through its 12-year history have focused on investing in African businesses with purpose and impact. For more information, please have a look at their website, www.exayocapital.com. That is www.exeocapital.com.